Finopo præsenterer dagens episode af Aktieuniverset. Aktiemarkedet det går op og ned, men hos Finopo sikrer vi gennemsnitligt vores kunder 54.000 kroner i øget årlig rådighedsbeløb. Og vi kan hjælpe 8 ud af 10 boligejere. Find os på finopo.dk.
Podcasten indeholder markedsføring af PMINDI og er ikke finansiel rådgivning. Mads, Mathias og New Deal Invest Fonde kan have positioner i de virksomheder, der tales om. Du finder relevante risici og link til PMINDI og dens vigtige dokumenter nederst i show notes. Husk, at investering altid medfører en risiko. Du lytter til Aktieuniverset med fundmanager og medstifter af New Deal Invest, Mads Christiansen, og tidligere professionel badmintonspiller og nu privatinvestor, Mathias Bo. Velkommen til Aktieuniverset.
We are living through an era of unprecedented change to our society as well as our economy.
Make no mistake about it. Growth is not just a financial issue, it is a strategic issue.
Velkommen til din ugentlige opdatering på det finansielle markeder. Mads. Vi har lavet interview med Eric Jackson. Hvis man skulle have brugt de sidste 2-3 måneder i en kummefryser, så er du måske lige på sin plads at nævne, at Eric Jackson han er altså en af de mest omtalte investorer, hedgefondmanagers, ikke bare, altså her taler vi altså ikke om lille Danmark, her taler vi altså om i hele verden. Det er Bloomberg, det er CNN, det er Yahoo Finance, og nu her ikke mindst Aktieuniverset, alle de store.
Og lytterne kan jo glæde sig, fordi ikke blot er han en af de mest omtalte, han er også en af de mest veltalende, vil jeg næsten sætte rigtig meget på. Jeg har ikke tjekket ind på Polymarket, men jeg tror, at han er højt op der.
Ja, det er mega, mega fed, helt chill fyr. Utrolig nemt interview. Man stillede bare et spørgsmål, så kørte pladen bare. Og vi havde spurgt efter 30 minutter, men han var altså ikke til at stå op, så det blev altså... En team, hvor han hyggede med os her i universet, det er vi selvfølgelig blevet rigtig stolte af, en kæmpe ære. Og det er jo selvfølgelig også hovedretten i det her afsnit. Vi prøver at korte de andre ting lidt ned, så løbeturen i skoven i morgen i det angiveligt dårlige vejr, i hvert fald i Odense omegn, ikke skulle blive for lang. Så det kigger vi på. Velkommen til. Vi skal have dagens første annoncør. Det er tempogrowth.dk. Hvad ligger der bag navnet?
Jamen, Tempogrowth er et marketingsbyrå. De hjælper små virksomheder med at få styr på deres marketingskampagne og marketingsstrategi. Så det er sådan ligesom at have en chief marketing officer, bare eksternt. Så de fungerer rigtig godt til små virksomheder, der har en marketingsansvarlig eller nogle få ansatte, hvor de så hjælper med at få sat struktur på og få en strategi for virksomheden. Og det vil altså på alle de her kanaler, som man er nødt til at være på i dag, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok osv. Det er et par, en mand og en kvinde, og det giver den her gode balance af, at der er altså nogle ting, Mathias, som kvinder bare er bedre til end os mænd med at gøre det
hele.
Med at gøre det pænt og sådan nogle ting. Altså, så det er en rigtig god kombination. Og vi bruger dem faktisk selv i New Deal Investor og kan varmt anbefale det, hvor at det har fået en bedre drejning, og jeg er blevet meget mere klar over, hvad det er, jeg skal, fordi at jeg løbende bliver coachet af Tempo Growth med hensyn til, hvad det er, jeg skal gøre for at gøre det rigtigt og opnå de mål, som vi har identificeret sammen med dem. Så ind på tempogrowth.com og hils fra Aktieuniverset. Det staves T-E-M-B-O og så growth.com.
Lad os starte, som altid, med et point på ugens indeks, hvordan det er gået. Det S&P'en ligger oppe 1%, vi optager her fredag eftermiddag. Vi har ikke fået gang i det amerikanske marked. Nu 1% op, indtil videre 0,5% DAO. Nasdaq op 1,5%. DAX i Tyskland, stort comeback, 3,6 oppe, 2,4 oppe i C25'eren på hjemmebanen. Den 10-årige rente i 4,08. Nu nærmer vi os snart det her 4% mark. Olien den er i 60 US dollar, euro dollar krydset. Uventet har fundet sådan sit leje omkring de her 1,16, 1,17, det ligger 1,17 i dag. pænt comeback til Bitcoin. 120.000 mod 108 i sidste år. Ethereum stiger også 4483, så guldet det kører også bare når på 3885. Det bliver sjovt, når vi når den her magiske 4000-grænse. Det kunne måske godt blive år stadigvæk, med hvis der er de her tiltagende lidt geopolitiske magtværk rundt omkring. Pæn uge. Vi retter op tabet fra sidste uge på indeksniveau. Lidt mere spændende. Hvilke sektorer er sådan rykket den her uge, eller fanget din interesse?
Jamen, altså, det er rigtig meget det samme. Det er de her sektorer, der er i geopolitisk fokus, der kører opad. Det vil sige, det er atomkraft, aktier. Det er også, der kommer også løbende gode nyheder ud fra kvantecomputersektoren, så det kører også op. Chipsektoren har været stærk i den her uge. K-Web også. Chipsektoren præget af Intel, og især den amerikanske, altså de virksomheder, der er eksponeret fra amerikansk chipsektor, klarer sig godt. Det vender vi tilbage til. Software stadigvæk svag på den her usikkerhed om, hvor god bliver forretningsmodellen for software fremadrettet. Og jeg tror man skal pas på med det, fordi at det har været sådan noget, der har været priset til perfektion, fordi det, vi har talt om det før, det her med, at man kan sådan trække streger ud i fremtiden, når man ser på, det, på væksten og sådan nogle ting, så det har været nemt også at prise det højt, fordi man siger bare, at væksten den fortsætter bare, men når lige pludselig, at der så er tvivl om væksten rent faktisk fortsætter, så bliver prissætningen en anden, og det er jeg ikke sikker på, at vi er færdige med. Så men en virkelig, virkelig god uge igen for det her nye tech generelt.
Ja, Nvidia er også 188 nu her. Den var jo en lille smule, jeg vil ikke sige nede, så meget har den jo ikke bakket, men den var alligevel lige ned omkring de 170, og så rykker nu her tilbage, ligger i all-time high. Selvfølgelig også spændende, og det er jo selvfølgelig også klart, at den hjælper på at trække indeksen op, når den her krabat ligger og kører i gult. Lad os kaste et øje på makroen. Lidt det her spændende, lidt lyder meget alvorligt, aktiemarkederne tager det så ikke så alvorligt, så alvorligt er det ikke, og det er jo selvfølgelig også gammel vin på nye flasker. Regeringsnedlukning i USA, vi har set det før, som nævnt, jeg tror også, vi har diskuteret det her i universet. Det skyldes simpelthen, at kongressen ikke kan nå til enighed om den her nye finanslov, eller en fortsættelseslov, som det hedder, og så trådte den her nedlukning altså i kraft første i 10. Som jeg nævner, umiddelbart burde aktiemarkederne reagere på det. Det gør de ikke. Det var positivt, både i går og onsdag, da den her nyhed kom. Så spændende er det jo så i princippet ikke alligevel.
Nej, historisk set har der ikke, altså historisk set cykler aktiemarkederne bare igennem de her nedlukninger. Det, hvis der er nedlukket i lang tid, så går det ud over GDP, at så falder det. Det der sker, det er jo, at det offentlige USA, altså det der er føderationen, når der ikke er penge til de ansatte der, så er man nødt til at sende de ansatte hjem, og så deler man det op i dem, som ligesom skal være på arbejde, og det holder man kørende, og så er der dem, som måske er overflødige, og dem sender man sig hjem. Og jeg tror ikke, man skal tage fejl af, at dengang Elon Musk overtog Twitter, der er en måde at finde ud af fra ham, hvilke udgifter, der var nødvendige, og hvilke, der ikke var. Det var simpelthen bare at slukke for kreditkortene. Og så begyndte folk at ringe og sagde, I har ikke betalt regningen, og så spurgte man, hvad betaler vi for, og sådan nogle ting. Og det er lidt den samme besked, som Trump har ude med i forhold til den offentlige sektor, at den offentlige sektor skal finde ud af, hvad er vigtigt her, hvad er nødvendigt, og hvad kan undværes. Så jeg er ikke sikker på, at man synes, det er så stor en katastrofe fra republikanernes side, fordi det er lidt videre med den her proces, man er i gang med at prøve at få skåret den offentlige sektor til, så det bliver super spændende at følge. Der er i hvert fald gang i skyttegravskrigen derovre, og der bliver kastet med både rådne tomater og æg og alt muligt mod hinanden fra begge lejre.
Hvad har du til makro den her uge?
Der er Altså USA giver militær garanti til Katar, og det synes jeg er spændende. Vi har nævnt det tidligere. J.D. Vance, han var ude og tale om, at alternative militære samarbejder burde være en mulighed og burde være på tegnebrættet. Og dengang havde man også den her vibe af, at det nok blev golfstaterne, som USA ville lave. Måske ikke nødvendigvis en NATO med, men i hvert fald sådan et militært samarbejde, eller det man også taler om med Ukraine nu her. Det, man kalder artikel 5, tror jeg, det er, man kalder det. Så jeg tror, at man er i gang med det, også i forbindelse med Gaza-freden, der man stiler imod, at lave sådan et mere forankret militært samarbejde med golfstaterne. Beskyttelse, og så skal de til gengæld investere og bruge amerikansk teknologi. Så er der den her historie med, at USA giver Europa og Ukraine adgang til offensive våben. Jeg kan virkelig ikke lide det. Altså, jeg synes ikke, vi i Danmark skal begynde at true med at skyde på Rusland. Altså, det, vi bor lige lidt for tæt på, og USA har meldt ud, at de skal kunne prioritere golfen og prioritere Asien, det sydkinesiske hav. Ja, jeg tænker lidt, at USA ligesom siger, jamen, hvis I vil, jamen så find ud af, hvor meget I vil, og gør det samme over for Rusland, og så måske på den måde håber, at stemningen for at finde en fred omkring der, hvor at frontlinjen er nu, at det bliver den fremadrettede løsning. Så er Taiwan i gang med at hjælpe USA med at opnå 50% markedsandel på chipproduktion. Det er sådan noget, man har forhandlet sig frem til. Howard Lutnick fortalte om det i et interview på en af de her platforme, hvor at man er kommet frem til, at det vil være godt for Taiwan og være godt for USA, og nu er den taiwanesiske regering begyndt at tilbyde støtte og garanteret lån til taiwanesiske virksomheder, som vil producere i USA. Så det går stille og roligt den vej, som man egentlig ønsker fra regeringens side. Og så, ja, og så synes jeg jo, det er spændende det her med, at vi ser tilbage på en september måned nu her, hvor vi på vej ind i september måned snakkede om, at det er den dårligste måned på året, og der var mange, der var ude og slå på trommer om, at PE var høj, og Jens Scherning, og vi herinde taler om det her med, jamen, PE er måske højere end grund, altså fordi at man ser frem mod en lysere fremtid, en fremtid, hvor teknologi gør, at det bliver bedre. Så det er spændende, hvor det bærer hen af. Altså, vores fonde er op med 17% i september måned, så det har virkelig gjort en alder at stå udenfor. Og jeg synes bare, at det er det der, man skal godt nok passe på med at prøve at time markedet med PE og sådan noget. Det er ikke til det. Det er til noget andet, så spændende tider, må man sige.
Ja, det er jo ikke den her boble, jeg i hvert fald ikke sprunget endnu, som eksperterne, de såkaldte eksperter, bliver ved med at sige, det er der. Det er jo, så den kører videre nu, og jeg tror også, den er tyk ud nu til at overleve noget tid endnu. Ja, men det kan man altid sige.
Ja, der er i hvert fald mange, der mener, at der er mere derude, og der er penge på sidelinjen, men altså ja, den kan jo springe, men vi kan få korrektionen når som helst, og så vil der være en masse, der siger, jamen, så fik vi ret, at der var en boble, men ja.
Det er blevet tid til lige at få kigget på, hvad der er blevet købt til porteføljerne. Jeg vil gerne lægge lidt kedeligt ud og sige, at der er nul handel, hverken den ene eller den anden vej, hos mig. Det er desværre, jeg sidder pænt med hænderne i lommen og nyder at se det ryge nordpå. Jeg vil lade den spændende del gå over til dig, som nok har været lidt mere aktiv.
Ja, altså, og vi tager bare meget gevinst i bund og grund, men vi skal jo også være 80% investeret i fondene, så man er også ude at finde noget, og det er også sjovt nok at finde noget af det, som måske har handlet svagt her. Og det som vi kigger på, og det er sådan lidt mere ude af, det er ikke så oplagt. Altså i de sidste par måneder, der har vi sagt Intel, og vi har sagt Circle, og vi har sagt Coinbase og sådan noget, det har bare været med, altså med sikkerhed og så videre, fordi at det er virkelig følt for. Og her, det er lidt mere små selskaber, så virkelig lige pas på og holde positionerne små. Men vi har købt lidt op i Firefly, hedder den, har tickeren FLY, og det er en virksomhed, som sender raketter op i atmosfæren med ting. Og de har en raket, der sprang i luften her i den her uge, og så faldt kursen rigtig meget. Og det må man bare sige, at det hører med til at være sådan en raketopstart, at en gang imellem, så er der altså nogle raketter, der springer i luften. Så jeg ser det som en købsmulighed, når der lige går panik i markedet der. Så den har vi købt op i. Så har vi købt i Chime Financials. Tickeren er CHYM, og det er sådan en fintech platform, der gerne vil være bank, også for altså en neobank, har en lidt anden forretningsmodel end SoFi. Men jeg har hørt nogle interviews med CEO'en og sådan noget. Jeg synes, det lyder spændende, men den gik på børsen, og så har den bare vendt næsen sydover lige siden. Og så det tror jeg kan være en meget god mulighed til at tage en lille bitte position. Kaspi har vi også købt. KSPI er tickeren. Det er den her kasakhstanske e-commerce platform, fintech startup af det. Ligger i Kazakhstan, så der er gang i synagogen derude, så der er stor geografisk risiko. Den er helt vildt billig og vokser meget, men altså, der risikoen er også stor, og så også små positioner der. Og så har vi købt op i Klaviyo, som jeg nok føler mig lidt mere sikker på. Tickeren er KVYO. Det er en platform, som hjælper virksomheder med at sælge mere ved at autogenerere mails og beskeder og sådan nogle ting. Og den falder i sympati med alle de andre softwareaktier rigtig meget. Grunden til, at vi tror, at den er lidt mere modstandsdygtig og har lidt mere at byde på i fremtiden, det er, at det egentlig starter som database. Så det vil sige, når de begynder at bygge AI, og det gør de jo allerede, bygge AI på deres platform, så betyder det bare, at de kan mere med den data, de har. Så det er tre bud, og det er bestemt ikke så high conviction som Intel og de her krypto-aktier har været tidligere.
Ja, men man kan også sige, at det er jo også et sted, hvor I har gjort det så fantastisk godt, og ligger også op med, vi får selvfølgelig lidt mere præcis opdatering senere, men rigtig, rigtig flot for ugen, så det er jo også de her, nogle gange, så skal man jo heller ikke nødvendigvis gå ud og tage de her kæmpe chancer, det synes jeg lige, vi skal diskutere en lille smule senere, så det virker virkelig fornuftigt, men omvendt skal man jo heller ikke bare holde ferie resten af året, og ikke prøve at optimere det, så det gælder jo selvfølgelig om at vride knuden, men man kan måske også sådan være en lille smule mere safe nu her, når man har gjort det. Det kan vi i hvert fald få dit take på.
I hvert fald, når tingene er steget meget, altså så er det meget godt ikke at løbe helt vildt efter det.
Vi skal have dagens anden annoncør. Det er pensionsplanlægning ved Hans Henrik.
Ja, Hans Henrik hjælper dig med at kigge pensionen, din pensionsordning igennem, både dig, som er på det sted, vi to er i livet, Mathias, hvor vi sådan begynder at tænke over, hvad har jeg, når jeg bliver pensioneret og sådan noget, og gør jeg det rigtigt lige nu, sådan at jeg har mest muligt. Men også for dem, som er på vej på pension, hvor man sådan skal have taget stilling til, hvilken rækkefølge skal jeg spise tingene i? Skal jeg spise mursten først, eller skal jeg spise min ratepension først, og sådan nogle ting. Så det er rigtig, rigtig vigtigt at få det optimeret rigtig godt. Og det som Hans Henrik fortæller, jamen det er, at de fleste hans kunder benytter i større eller mindre grad de forkerte opsparingsprodukter, har trykket på de forkerte produkter, får pengene sat de forkerte steder, og det er både i vores alder, men også når man bliver pensioneret som 60-årig, eller 65 eller 68-årig, eller sådan noget, så har man jo mange år tilbage at leve i, så det er vigtigt, at det står rigtigt. Man har tit for lidt aktier i opsparingen, og der hjælper Hans Henrik også med sådan at få taget stilling til, hvad skal man have af aktier, hvor skal de ligge, og hvad skal ligge i obligationer, og hvad skal ligge i fast ejendom, og sådan nogle ting. Og så kigger han det hele igennem og finder tit besparelser, altså simpelthen, at der er for høje omkostninger på de løsninger og produkter, man har valgt. Og der hjælper det rigtig meget, hvis man har en uvildig rådgiver, som hjælper en med at sige, du skal lige ringe til din bank og så sige, at her skal du have et bedre deal, eller så kan jeg hjælpe dig med at pege på en anden bank, hvor du eventuelt kan få noget andet. Så, og det giver bare, at man har mere til rådighed alderen.
Det er skide fedt, det her uvildige rådgiver. Jeg ved godt, vi siger det tit, men det er det jo bare, at man får bare en teamplayer på sit hold, som peger en lige præcis ned ad den vej, man skal gå ned af. Hop ind på pensionsplanlægning.dk og læs mere.
Og det er planlægning med E.
Det er blevet tid til en nyhedsrundtur. Vi starter lige med de korte af slagsen.
Ja, Robin Hoods CEO, Vlad Tenev, var på en konference, hvor han sagde, jeg citerer, "Tokenization is a freight train, and it'll eat the entire financial system. It really starts to get interesting when all of these assets, public and private, get on crypto technology. The push to make it easier to trade real-world assets by linking them to blockchains will expand the addressable market from low single digit trillions to tens of trillions of dollars." Det er vi har taget Robin Hood i porteføljen på E2 i det her kvartal. Føler vi har misset den, men føler også, at vi er enormt tidligt i det her, og det passer meget godt med det, Vlad Tenev siger her. Der har også været snak ind på vores Twitter-profil, eller Twitter-konto om Robin Hood, om tog, der er kørt, og sådan nogle ting. Og det er svært at købe noget, der er sten så meget, men igen, man kan gøre det der med at forsikre sig imod, at det bare stiger ind i himlen herfra ved at købe en lille position, og så egentlig bare håbe på, at det falder, og gør det ikke det, så er man i hvert fald med. AMD er i snak med Intel om at skulle producere på Intels Foundry. Peloton hæver priserne, og markedet kan slet ikke finde ud af, hvordan de skal prise Peloton i øjeblikket. Altså det er den her meget lidt overskudsgivende virksomhed, og hvis de bare kan blive lidt mere profitable, så kan det blive rigtig meget. Det er spændende.
Så er der kom... vi stoppe lige med den? Der har vi jo et langt vedmål ude der. Der har jeg jo stadig hunderetten. Den har vi helt glemt. Den har du slet ikke opdateret fra. Det var godt, du lige mindede mig om, hvordan jeg bare pryler dig i den aktie. 91% nede i det sidste år. Har du den stadigvæk, Mads, eller hvad? Eller må du give fortabt og indrømme, at jeg har ret?
Nej, vi er jo oppe. Vi er jo oppe her på det seneste. Jeg tror, vi er oppe med 50%.
Nå, okay.
Fra ingenting til halvanden gang ingenting.
Så er du slubret helt ned i bunden, men det må man jo også godt, det er der jo ingen regler for. Men undskyld.
Ja, tak. Undskyld. Bare sig undskyld. Ja, bare sig undskyld en gang mere. Så er der kommet bare en ChatGPT, så når ChatGPT lige har fundet hjælp med at finde den rigtige kaffelatte-maskine, så kan man lige trykke på knappen, og så kommer den med DoorDash inden for en halv time eller sådan et eller andet. Jamen, det er jo fantastisk. Jeg kom bare sådan til at tænke på, hvad sker der så med Pinterest-agtigt? Altså, vil vi stadigvæk bruge den og så videre? Og jeg ved det ikke. Det er nok dig, der mere bruger Pinterest end mig, Mathias.
Jeg tror måske, jeg bruger ChatGPT mere end dig, men jeg bruger ikke så meget Pinterest. Jeg har ikke nogen hjem, jeg skal smukkesere som yderligere, men jeg synes jo, det er smart, men det giver jo vildt god mening, det der. Jeg tror bare stadigvæk, lige umiddelbart, så synes jeg stadigvæk, nu jeg har jo den her opgraderede version af ChatGPT, jeg synes altså stadigvæk, der er mange fejl i den. Mm. Altså, så det er ikke helt så trustworthy som folk, der går ind og lægger de her ting op, personer. Altså for eksempel, det var sjovt, at jeg skulle google livescore på en OB-kamp i sidste uge, så spørger jeg, hvad står der, så siger den har ikke fundet kampen. Og så siger jeg så, hvad tid starter den? Den startede klokken 5. Og så hvad resultater? Der var den 7:30. Men der er ikke noget resultat endnu. Og så viser sig, skriver jeg, hvor har du søgt henne? Jamen, den her søgt andet sted, er det ikke relevant at søge på bold.dk eller et eller andet andet. Så jeg havde lige en slåskamp med den. Og så, nå jo, det var da også smart, tænkte den så. Hvor det er sådan lidt, ah, okay, OB tabte så. Men det gør de jo så om, men relativt tit. Det er jo så ikke ChatGPT's skyld. Men i dag skal jeg sgu faktisk ud til fodbold. Nå, undskyld, videre.
Fedt. Ja. Ja, ja, altså hvis du bliver ved med at forstyrre sådan her hele tiden, så bliver det virkelig en lang løbetur. Ja. CoreWeave, de laver en aftale med Meta om at lige at sælge for 14 milliarder dollars datacenter. Så der er gang i det, der er virkelig gang i AI-datacenter økosystemet. Og så Mercado Libre på vej ind i B2B e-commerce, altså ud over at sælge til private, så vil de også sælge til virksomheder. Det giver mening, de har betalingssystemet op at køre, og de har infrastruktursystemet op at køre, så det er bare at tage for sig. I den her uge, der har Nubank og Mercado Libre har handlet svagt. Jeg tror, man lige skal passe på med at se det som købsmulighed, fordi jeg tror, det hænger sammen med det, der sådan foregår geopolitisk med spændingerne mellem Trump og Brasilien. USA lægger pres på i Venezuela, og der, USA har også lavet den her swap line til Argentina, hvor man tilbyder, hjælper den argentinske regering med ligesom at stabilisere valutaen ved at veksle dollars for deres valuta, 20 milliarder dollars, og så er der dollars i systemet i Argentina, og man bremser ligesom inflationen, fordi man har noget, der holder værdien, og så veksler man så tilbage igen på et tidspunkt. Og der overtager USA den her stabiliserende økonomisk effekt på Argentina fra Kina, som tidligere har kørt de her swap lines. Og det er bare sådan, USA trumler virkelig på i Latinamerika nu, og det, man kunne godt forestille sig, at når så Mercado Libre og Nubank pludselig falder 5% i torsdags, at det er fordi, der er nogen, der hører et eller andet på vandrørene. Så det er ikke lige dem, jeg køber ind i på de her fald.
Så er vi forbi Alphabet. De har accepteret at betale 24,5 millioner dollars på den her Donald Trumps krav om, at han blev blokeret for at poste på deres YouTube-channel, altså det her sådan, illegalt censorship. 22 millioner dollars, dem smider Trump til construction af det her nye ballroom i Det Hvide Hus, og så de sidste 2,5 millioner dollars, de går så til omkostninger i forbindelse med hans retssag og sådan nogle ting. Så vi har jo talt om det her med, Trump han prøver at samle den her, hvor det her sådan har været lidt tidligere, hvor bank dem i hovedet. Det kan man altså så sige, at det er det jo selvfølgelig også at bank dem med 24 millioner dollars, men 24 millioner dollars for Alphabet er jo, at det svarer jo til, at vi to taber 5 kroner ud på vejen. Det er jo ikke noget, som overhovedet ødelægger det. Og det virker jo også som om, at han bare vil have klattet det her af, og er fint med, at de her penge går til sådan ligesom i statskassen til at renovere Det Hvide Hus og sådan noget. Så det virker som om den her plan med at få samlet de her store selskaber og ligesom gøre, at det kan booste tingene, som vi har talt om mange gange, jamen det kører der ud af, og den her retssag, den skulle nok afsluttes på en eller anden måde, så det tænkte jeg var måske en smart måde at gøre det på.
Ja, det virker også som om, at det virker også principielt, det her. Altså, det virker som om, at det her, det skal lige i tale sættes. Og noget af det, man kører meget på med, det er jo den her ytringsfrihed, og at pressen skal være neutral, eller i hvert fald melde ud, hvis den er partisk. Og der er en masse i gang indenrigspolitisk i USA med at få ryddet op i det. Og jeg tror, jeg er ude og holde oplæg her i onsdags. Og noget af det, som jeg også talte om, det er det her med, sammenhængskraften i Vesten er rigtig dårlig i øjeblikket. Når man taler om, hvordan kommer vi i Europa i gang igen, altså med at rykke på teknologisk udvikling og alt det her, vi skal, jamen så skal vi lige være enige først. Altså, fordi ellers så kan man ikke rigtig som nation noget. Og hvis vi hele tiden har den her meget polariserede debat, hvor det hele tiden handler om, at nogen er de onde, og nogen er de gode, så kommer vi aldrig i gang med samtalen, og så får vi ikke den her sammenhængskraft. Og jeg tror virkelig, at det ligesom er kernen i problemet i Vesten i øjeblikket, og det er man fra den her gruppe Silicon Valley-folk meget opmærksom på. Altså den gruppe, der er omkring regeringen nu, det er hvad han hedder, Alex Karps pointe fra hans bog The Technological Republic. Så jeg tror, at det her, det er sådan et led i at prøve at få, på en eller anden måde, at få debatten mere åbnet op, sådan at vi kan sige, hvad vi synes.
Så stopper Daniel Ek med Spotify.
Ja, han træder tilbage og bliver bestyrelsesformand. Han har gjort det ret godt, og han er stadigvæk ung. Altså, jeg tror, han er 42 eller sådan noget. Det er virkelig, virkelig vildt, hvad han har formået. Og han er bare dygtig. Altså, han er også en dygtig forretningsmand. Han er sådan en tech-iværksætter, men er også vokset ind til at være en super dygtig, langsigtet tænkende forretningsmand. Og så har han jo lavet den her løsning med, at han får en todelt ledelse. Det er Gustav Söderström, som er CTO, altså Chief Technical Officer, og så er det Alex Nordström, som har stået for forretningsudvikling, marketing, indhold, sådan nogle ting, altså hvordan man monetiserer platformen. Og det vil sige, at det er ikke CTO, eller det er ikke CFO'en, altså det er ikke Chief Financial Officer. Når man sådan ser på Apple, Tim Cook, han var Chief Financial Officer, man kan godt diskutere, om Apple har været innovativ nok under hans virke. Alibaba, ham der kom efter Jack Ma, det var Chief Financial Officer, og det er noget af det Simon, vores kineser i New Deal Invest, taler rigtig meget om, at det har sådan været en stille periode for Alibaba, og nu er de lige skiftet til en ny leder i Alibaba, og lige pludselig så er der priskrig med Meituan, og de skal ekspandere til Europa og sådan noget. Lige pludselig så kommer der helt anderledes gang i den, og det er lidt det, der sker, når det bliver en Chief Financial Officer, der overtager efter founderen. Og der har Daniel Ek i hvert fald vandt en anden tilgang, og så en todelt ledelse med to entreprenører, to der udvikler forretningen, altså har den sådan positiv fremadrettet tilgang til forretningen. Det tror jeg, jeg synes det er spændende, og jeg synes det er potentielt godt set, at det er den det er de kompetencer, man skal have i front i stedet for. Nu skal vi høre Eric Jackson tale Open Door, og det var også Open Door, det var også deres CFO, som blev CEO efter følgende, og Eric han taler om, hvordan han var med til at få skiftet CFO'en ud.
OpenAI, de har lavet den her handel gå igennem så tidligere, og current ansatte, de kan sælge aktier for 6,6 milliarder af deres de her medarbejderaktier, som den er altid en del af de her lønpakker i USA, og det har de altså fået lov at sælge til en 500 billion valuation, og de her aktier, de blev så snappet op af Thrive Capital, SoftBank, T. Rowe Price, nogle af de her store selskaber, som ligger på lur. Og hvis jeg havde haft fingrene sådan nogle, så kunne man selvfølgelig godt sige, at det er fint at kasse ind, men når man kan se, det SoftBank blandt andet, som snapper dem op, så ved man nok, at de kommer til at blive mere værd, for hold da op, hvor har den bare gjort det fuldstændig vanvittigt, SoftBank-aktien. Det er helt vildt, som de bare bliver ved med at rulle derudad. Så ikke desto mindre, så er der jo selvfølgelig også blevet kasset godt ind. Det var jo, jeg tror, sidste valuation var på 200 millioner, hvis jeg ikke husker helt fejl, noget i den dur i hvert fald. Og nu er vi altså en valuation på det her selskab, som man ikke kan købe på børsen, fordi det stadigvæk er privat, men en valuation, hvis man skulle købe det på 500 billion US dollars, så er meget, 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 meget interessant.
Ja, der er jo snakken omkring det her med cirkulær økonomi. Nvidia investerer i OpenAI også, og de investerer i hinanden alle sammen. Og det er bare det her med, at det er så store beløb og så stort, at, at det er rart at dele risikoen, det er rart at være flere om risikoen. Nvidia har også en interesse i OpenAI, fordi OpenAI kører ikke endnu selv med egne chips, hvorimod Google og Amazon og Microsoft, altså de satser mere og mere på deres egne chips, så det er også rart for Nvidia ligesom at have en aktør, som går med egne chips. Til det der med cirkulær økonomi, altså det er stadigvæk investeringer, som de her virksomheder gør. Det er jo ikke ligesom dengang, at vi havde ejendomsboblen, hvor dem, der ejede ejendommene, de købte og solgte til hinanden til højere og højere priser, og dermed det underliggende aktive her, altså AI-datacentre, ser ud til at blive en ret stor succes i fremtiden, har i hvert fald stort potentiale, så jeg er ikke sådan enig i den tolkning.
Så var der en IPO den her uge, Fermi, den her data-infrastruktur- og energiplatform, som har til formål at forsyne de her datacenter med elektrisk kapacitet. Den gik på børsen, startede rigtig, rigtig godt. Jeg tror faktisk også, den lå foran, da jeg lavede det her manus til den i går, men så synes jeg, at den lukkede, at den faldt en smule tilbage. Ja, det gjorde den, og den falder også en lille smule i dag, men stadigvæk fornuftig start. Går på til 20 og ligger i 27 nu og var op i løbet af første handelsdag op i $40 og dobbelt aktiekursen fra start af. Jeg kan ikke lige se, hvornår retail-investorerne kunne være med derfra. Men spændende, interessant virksomhed, som virkelig taler ind i det, og vi stort set bruger timer på hver eneste gang og taler om. Så jeg tænker, at det er i hvert fald lige en aktie, man skal holde lidt mere øje med. Og ja, jeg ved ikke lige, hvor meget du har kigget på den, Mads, men vi kan måske også lige næste gang lige have få dine øjne på det, og så kan vi lige tage det der. Og se, hvad du siger til den. Så lad os bare lige prøve at komme over til Circle en gang. Det har også været en fremragende uge for dem.
Ja, Circle er i annonceret samarbejde med Deutsche Börse her i går, og stiger så 16% på den. Altså, jeg tror stadigvæk, vi er enormt tidligt i hele den her blockchain-cyklus, og det er også det, som Vlad Tenev fra Robin Hood sagde tidligere. Robin Hood har også handlet stærkt, som jeg talte om, og Coinbase og så videre. Så jeg tror stadigvæk, hvis ikke at man er sten på det tog, så er det mit bud, at det er et godt bet stadigvæk. Nu er det jo sten noget, altså så det skal man altid passe på, jo, og så videre, og yada, 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 med små positioner.
Godt, vi lige hurtigt Tesla kommet med leveringstal for tredje kvartal. Det så bedre ud, end analytikerne regnede med. Det skyldes også den her 7.500 tax redemption, man får, hvis man har købt her i tredje kvartal. De får altså leveret 497.000 biler, og det var bedre end de her 439.000, som eksperterne eller analytikerne har regnet med. Aktien rører sig ikke rigtig ud af det på baggrund af de her tal, men den har jo også fået stort, stort comeback her de sidste par måneder, så den her er selvfølgelig fint for dem at få det her med, men ja, det var nok indregnet, og jeg sidder sådan lidt og tænker, jamen det er heller ikke derfor, man køber Tesla mere. Nej, det kan godt være, det lyder helt idiotisk at sige, jamen det er ikke på grund af deres, men altså det tror jeg, og det er lidt sådan, når man tænker tilbage på Elon Musk omkring alt det her med, at han går ind og støtter til at starte med Trump, og måske ikke så meget uvenner med ham mere, omkring det her med, at det er helt fint, at vi ikke skal have alt det her eller batteridrevet biler og alle sådan nogle ting også, for jeg tror bare, at det er det, han bruger til at funde maskineriet i øjeblikket, og så kommer der noget andet, som han er temmelig sikker på nok skal gøre det. Så jeg tror i hvert fald bare ikke, at man skal tænke det så meget ind i det, selvom at det selvfølgelig kan lyde lidt åndssvagt i nogens ører, men så må man grine lidt af mig på baggrund af det senere hen, men det er ligesom mit take på det. Vi skal have dagens tredje og sidste annoncør. Det er en månedsopdatering fra New Deal Investors fonde.
Ja, og det er jo det her med, at kursen kan godt snyde, når man ser PMI-NDI, så derfor vil vi rigtig gerne lige nævne, hvordan det går. Og det er jo det her med, at vi har udbetalt 21% i udbytte i januar, og så på nogle platforme, der regner man ikke udbytte med i i afkastet, der ser man kun kursudvikling. Men vi er nu oppe med ved slutningen af måneden her med 29% på Pemindi i år, den afregnes i kroner, så det er jo altså så efter dollarmodvinden. Så det her med dollarmodvind er overgjort. Vi har også talt om det. Det er mere spørgsmål om, altså hvis virksomhederne sælger i udlandet også, så er det ikke noget problem. Hvis udgifterne er i USA, så er det heller ikke lige så stort et problem. NDI FutureTech er vores portefølje inde på E2. Den er i dollar, og derfor så er den op med 48% i år. Og så har vi NDI AlphaTech, som startede her i marts, hvor man kan have sin VSO på, fordi den er akkumulerende. Den er op med 51%, og den kører på samme måde som Pemindi, men den startede bare på et mere heldigt tidspunkt, sådan lidt nede i nedturen. Og så er det vigtigt at sige igen, altså at historisk afkast kan man ikke bruge som, altså som due diligence eller sådan noget. Man skal finde ud af, hvordan det passer ind i ens investering og så videre. Det der er, og så skal man huske at være langsigtet, fordi de her aktier, som vi investerer i, de falder altså rigtig meget en gang imellem. Ligesom i 2022, hvor det hele bare skvattede med 70%, det var så formentlig også en omvendt boble, altså et fuldstændig urealistisk udsalg. Men det kan komme, og man kan ikke vide, hvornår det kommer. Så små positioner osv., hvis man vælger at investere med os i en New Deal Invest.
Tak for det, Skæmeren. Jeg synes, I gør det pisse godt, så det vil jeg gerne sige, når du nu ikke selv siger det.
Tak. Det er også lidt fedt.
Det er det, jeg godt forstår. Mads, noget, der også var fedt, det var det her interview. Jeg er jo selvfølgelig svært begejstret. Det skal vi over til med Erik. Det kommer her.
Podcasten indeholder markedsføring af PMINDI og er ikke finansiel rådgivning. Mads, Mathias og New Deal Invest Fonde kan have positioner i de virksomheder, der tales om. Du finder relevante risici og link til PMINDI og dens vigtige dokumenter nederst i show notes. Husk, at investering altid medfører en risiko.
It's a huge pleasure to introduce you, Erik Jackson, to our listeners. We have really been looking forward to this interview. We have followed Open Door, specifically here latest, and yeah, of course, like our listeners who have heard about it is super excited to know that you're with us and unfold this story. So welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I love your podcast. I started listening like a few years ago, and so don't always catch the Danish parts, but I definitely know that one of the great things about the whole Open Door journey for me has been just how many international supporters there are for the stock, even despite the fact that Open Door is only available in the United States. And there certainly are a bunch in Denmark and Scandinavia more broadly. So great pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Erik Jackson and your hedge fund, how you got to where you are and who you are.
Well, I'm pretty old for, maybe not again, not versus you, Matt, I'm always meeting.
It's always Matthias' line, and you start saying it, so it's just, oh my God.
I'm always meeting these guys. Like yesterday I was talking to a CEO who's like 30 years old, and I was like, wow, these guys are like getting a lot done way, way earlier than I did in my career. Mm. But I started 25 years ago. I did a PhD at Columbia University in New York at the business school in strategy and management, and didn't know like what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to become a business school professor. I wanted to work in the real world and make a mark. But that was around the time of .com. I got started working for a company in Toronto that was a software company that was luckily was a real company, not just some like website or something slapped together for that era. And got to work in tech, loved it. Went through the whole .com nuclear winter period after the things went bust. And, the people who stayed working in tech at that time obviously loved it. And many of them have gone on to like great things in their careers. So I have made some great contacts through that. But I didn't, you know, danced around, worked in management consulting with my father for a few years, then started an activist campaign against Yahoo in like 2007, trying to leverage social media at that time, like Facebook groups and blogs and wikis and YouTube videos and stuff. But it was a big failure. You know, it went on like 10 years. My relationship with Yahoo didn't accomplish anything, didn't really make any money from it. But the one way that it was helpful was sort of learning what boards do to basically try to stop you as an activist investor. And that became important when I started in on Open Door. It was also helpful because through that whole experience, I met a lot of great people at Yahoo who worked at the company in mid-level management, who were very supportive of what I was doing as an outsider, criticizing the company, asking the company to change. Because again, like those were talented people who had no place else to go at that time, because there was no startup scene the way that there is today after .com bust. Like there were no, you know, you couldn't join the OpenAI at the time. You either had to go work for eBay or Yahoo. This was even like before Google. And so there were great people at Yahoo, despite the fact that most people think of Yahoo as a failure. One guy I met and became a billionaire, like in, you know, a few years later after I met him, I guess as one does in Silicon Valley, I guess it's very easy, you know, easy to become, just stumble into becoming a billionaire. And so he gave me my start, starting my little hedge fund, maybe like 10 years ago, saying like, hey, I like the way you think, Eric, how about I give you some money to manage? So I got my start with him, did some great things. You know, as you know, you guys know, like there was lots of exciting companies at the latter part of last decade, like Carvana, Roku, Twilio. Like I had some like big hits investing in these smaller growth oriented companies. But then I got smacked in the head in 2021 and 2022 because all of those companies like basically had big belly flops as interest rates rose. So I didn't do well then. The billionaire decided to leave my hedge fund at the end of 22, and I hadn't done a good job planning.
He had a poor timing.
Yeah, so like I should have been smarter, but like here I was thinking like, oh, I've got this billionaire in my back pocket. He's always going to be here. He's always going to be supporting me through kind of the ups and downs. And so I didn't do a good job of like, you know, beating the bushes for other investors. So at the end of that time, I had to kind of pick myself up and kind of get through the next period. I had a lot of people like, you have to pay a lot of money to run a hedge fund because, you know, there's lawyers and there's directors and people in the Cayman Islands that cost an extra amount of money because they think everything that they do should be like five times as expensive as it is in the United States or Canada. And they were all telling me you should shut your fund down. Like now that this guy's pulled his money out, it's unsustainable. It's too expensive. And plus you have this like up and down performance. You should try to like pretend like that bad performance in 21 and 22 never happened. You know, so if you just close your fund, you could open a new fund in 6 months and then you don't have to tell anybody about your bad performance from before. And it looks like you started from fresh. And you know, that didn't feel right to me. And I didn't want to shut the doors on my fund. So I just kept going and I hired a little AI team of engineers, mostly in Canada and in the US to work for me and try to build some models that I thought were going to show some promise. And one of the first models that we built flagged Carvana in May of 2023 and said it should be like the number two position in my fund. And so I knew Carvana, obviously, because I'd made some money from it, trading it like after it IPO'd. But I was a little surprised that this AI model was right out of the gate telling me to be make it the number two long position in my fund. And so I was, you know, that was when Carvana was like $11 a share. It had gone down from 400 to a low of $3.50 in December of 22. And it was sort of on its way back up. And
Eric, I think our listeners actually know Carvana really well because it's one of the stocks we cover a lot. I'm really curious, what what was it that your model was able to see through, or what did it see in Carvana at that time?
At that time, this first model that we were building, it was a much more technically driven model, and so therefore the features that it focused in on were more more momentum, volume features, above a certain moving average. We had sort of like tracked a unique set of like moving averages that, you know, what the moving average that mattered for Carvana, for example, was different than the moving average that mattered for Apple or, you know, like one of the Mag 7 stocks. And, you know, it being smaller and more volatile, you can imagine it. It was a shorter kind of moving average that mattered. But there were certain volume spikes that the model picked up on that kind of indicated that this company, like there was like a renewed interest in it. There were things that we looked at that were signs of capitulation, again, more from a technical perspective than anything else. So those were the kinds of things that the model was picking up on at that time. But it was still a few months removed from the December bottom. But another thing that factored into my deciding that, okay, I'm going to trust this model in May of that year was that I had been obviously following, Carvana before that and all the way down in 2022. And I had noticed that the CEO, Ernie Garcia Jr., he had bought a significant amount of stock in 2022. So in two tranches, like he bought $50 million, 50, in March of 22. I think it was around $50 a share on the way down from 400. And then he bought another $20 million worth of Carvana stock in June of 22 at around $20 a share. And, you know, that I knew that Ernie got a lot of hate because of his father, in the 1990s, you know, was involved in the savings and loan crisis in the United States, where he sort of pled no contest to some accusation that the SEC made against him at the time. I forget what it was. But so he made a deal basically with the government to basically put that behind him. And I know, but ever since then, I knew that there was a certain number of people, even in the, 2016, 17, 18, they would always like, you know, all the bears, you know, one of their go-tos was like, this company's just run by a bunch of criminals because of this one deal by the father who had been involved in starting the company. And so that stuck on the sun. So anyway, I they would always say like, oh yeah, Ernie Garcia Jr., like, yeah, he's buying stock, but it doesn't really count because he's rich. well, I don't agree with that. Like, I believe that, like, even if you're rich, I mean, I don't care how rich you are. $70 million worth of, you know, spending of your own money is you don't do that to set it on fire. You'd only do that if you like truly believe in the company. But the other thing that caught my eye about Carvana, though, was that I think there was a couple of directors who had bought stock as well that year in 22, like over the summer. Not huge, something like on the order of like $100,000 for maybe one guy and maybe $200,000 worth of stock for another director. That's usually the way that directors, they usually don't buy a lot. But then in November of 22, during American Thanksgiving, or right before American Thanksgiving, I remember there were two junior members of the Carvana management team that bought stock. You know, one was a guy named Dan Gill, who's the chief product officer there, and he bought $3 million worth of stock. And when the stock was $7.50. And then there was another guy who bought about $700,000 worth of stock. And so one thing I knew from, this goes back to like when I was a PhD student at Columbia, I remember like we used to, I for my doctoral thesis, I remember I had to hire like three guys who were undergraduates at the time at Columbia to go down to the SEC's physical library, which was in the World Trade Center before it got bombed or whatever, hit by the planes. And they would actually physically have to photocopy the SEC filings, like the, you know, the proxy statements that would list, you know, information about the directors and officers of every company for my thesis. And then they would photocopy them, and then they'd come back to Columbia, and then they would code them into like a little spreadsheet. So then that I could like later do a linear regression about like what sorts of like, did ages matter? Did backgrounds matter? Did education or work experience matter in terms of predicting different outcomes? And so one of the things that I remember studying back then is that, or seeing is like people, you know, insiders sell for all kinds of reasons. And that's just like it doesn't really signify anything about their confidence in the business. They sort of do it like almost like a treating it like an ATM, you know, taking money out, you know, oh, I gotta spend some money now for my family. Oh, we gotta buy a new house or something, or we gotta renovate our house. So I'm gonna take some money out. It doesn't mean that they're any less confident in their businesses, but when they buy shares, like that's much less common. And when they do it, it's usually very significant. And it usually doesn't happen very often. It might only happen like once every 10 years for a given company when you see like, you know, and usually it's only one insider that buys, typically the CEO. And typically the CEO, like he knows that everything he does is under the microscope and will take symbolic importance. And so they might do it as a sign of confidence. But to see this, a chief product officer who's buying $3 million worth of stock like that, I never saw that in any of those like filings, you know. And so Dan, I didn't know, but he followed me on Twitter at the time. So I reached out to him and we had a conversation in either late December or kind of early January of 23. And I found out he was Canadian. I didn't know that. Yeah, like I'm Canadian. And he was from this small town called Kingston, 2 hours down the highway from Toronto. And but now he lives in California. He worked for Carvana basically from the beginning. He went to Stanford, and that's how he met Ernie Garcia. And there were like a bunch of people that were part of the management team that knew each other from Stanford, and then they decided to start this company together. And so the conversation I had with Dan is like I sort of complimented him for making this big purchase at that time. Like we were only like 1 month removed from the bottom for Carvana stock. So it was very much like still seen as this black sheep type company. I mean, if you looked at on X at the time, I mean, everybody hated Carvana. Everybody was making fun of Carvana. There are all these people on X who like work for hedge funds, you know, most of them in New York, some of them like in San Francisco or other cities. And they, you know, they have all these like fake names, right? They never put their own names out there. They'll say like, I'm, you know, Dumb Luck Capital or Stupid This, Stupid That Capital, you know, whatever. And some of them have like quite a following, you know, 50,000, 100,000 or whatever followers. So I guess they say interesting things, but they're too afraid to put their identities out there because, you know, maybe they think they're going to say something dumb one day and their boss won't like it and they'll get fired. And so they just sort of keep the anonymity. And I noticed all those people really loved dancing on the grave of Carvana. On it, they would say, you know, they joke about the criminal thing, all the bunch of criminals. Oh yeah, like you know, I guess there was an assumption that if you're working on a management team and you let your stock go from $400 to $3, you must be stupid, and therefore, like, there's no way you're ever going to come back from that. And so, but when I talked with Dan, he was obviously very bright, very smart, but it was also I didn't realize like how connected those management team people were with each other from Stanford. And he wasn't delusional about the challenges that they faced. I mean, he said things like, hey, you know, we're in a tough spot right now. You know, we got the deck is sort of stacked against us, but you know, we really believe in each other. We really believe in the company and the product and the mission and why we started this company. And we're going to fight and we're going to, you know, we think we can get through it. You know, he wasn't saying for sure, you know, we're going back to $400 or anything like that, but you could hear the confidence in his voice. And it really had an impact on me, so much so that I ended up writing an email to Ernie Garcia, even though I'd never met him. Like a week, you know, a few days after that. And then I posted it. Now it's on my X like pinned. It's a pinned tweet, so people can read it. But I sort of said to Ernie, and this was like in January of 23, you know, like, I got to tell you, like, this is really uncommon stuff to have people on your team that buy this amount of stock that these guys did. And you should feel really commended for being a leader of a team where you have that kind of loyalty and confidence. And, you know, so it makes me think, based on, you know, watching different companies over the years, that you guys are going to make it. And so he wrote back, and I didn't publish that part, but he basically said, you know, wow, thanks very much. And, you know, I know from my own personal experience, when I go through down times, like when the billionaire pulled his money out, like a lot of people just turn their back on you. You know, people that you think are friends and believe in you and will always be, you know, friendly with you, suddenly they're not. And sometimes even within your own family or like really close friends. And so, but when you have people at those low moments who say, hey, I believe in you. Hey, you know, you're doing the right thing. Keep going. Stick with it. Like, that really make, you know, you never forget those people. I will never forget those people for me. And so I wanted to kind of, I guess, be a voice of, I don't know, confidence for Ernie at that time. And he still remembers it. Like, you know, I had an exchange. I haven't met him, but I emailed him a few months ago, and, you know, he remembered that email. So anyway, like that. So when the model suddenly came back, you know, a few months later and said, hey, you got to make this the number two position in your portfolio. I mean, we checked it. Like, we didn't just take it blindly and like jump into the position. You know, we made sure like the model wasn't hallucinating or anything. But because of knowing that Dan and knowing Ernie, you know, it made me much more confident in the model that, you know, and in Carvana and their ability to turn around.
So I'm really curious here, because I want to ask you about what gives edges when investing, because this was a story of a model that gave you a signal, which could be noise or it could be something, but it was something different, and there was a lot of noise, a lot of people being the consensus was that Carvana was going bankrupt, and if you look at the earnings report at that time, you would probably come to the conclusion that, or at least if you didn't dig deep enough and thoroughly understood the company. And then you did some research via channels, and I know you speak about that you have a really good network from your Yahoo days. So I wanted to ask you about, where does edges come from in this world? Is it mainly like you figure out the right price of the stock, or is it more like this, that you find something sticking out, something out of the ordinary?
Well, I think besides crypto, like, and I have plans for like a crypto treasury company, which is going to come public hopefully in November. But, you know, putting that aside, like in my hedge fund, like now I'm like always focused on what I call 100 baggers, which are like public stocks where I think it has, you know, over a 3, 4, 5 year period, the stock has a chance to 100x. I won't be sad if some of them only become 50xers or something like that, you know, but because it's pretty rare to find like these public stocks that do 100x. But I think like there's two types of companies that have the highest probability of 100xing. One is like a walking dead type of company, like a Carvana, where the market just gives up on it and it's like sells it off, and it like has this huge decline from all-time highs. And so those would be like companies like, you know, Carvana, Opendoor, Peloton, Upstart. I don't know. What's another good one? You know, these ones that just got left for dead, right? And then the other type of company that can make a big comeback like that would be like undiscovered, unknown companies. So like I've had a couple of those in Canada. Like they were listed only in Canada. And they weren't that well known in the US. But like, finding them early, shining a spotlight on them, you know, building a wider audience for them, those ones have done well. So, you know, I'm sure like there's probably something, some methodology I could follow to, you know, search others on the Stockholm Exchange or whatever. I don't know. You guys have one in Denmark, and there's probably some companies you can look at there too. Poland, you know, places like this, you know, when you start to say like, okay, like let's build a database of these companies that have made these like dramatic turnarounds, like Carvana, I think, you know, I've done that, and there's a bunch of technical factors you can look at. And I talked about some of those before on the podcast. There's like fundamental things you could look at. I mean, obviously like Carvana going from losing money to showing that they could sustainably make money, like that's an important inflection point. Same thing for Open Door, same thing for like, you know, all these other kinds of companies. Like if Peloton, like I'm sort of, they are profitable, but they're marginally profitable. Like what's it going to take to push them into like dramatically profitable? I mean, that's sort of like, you know, what the new CEO there has to do. So there's fundamental things, technical things, there's like insider buying, we've talked about that. So there's probably a list of about 40 different features, I call them, like that, you know, come under those categories, that you could write out a list that are present. If I had a list of like 20 stocks that have made this sort of dramatic comeback. But the funny thing is, I found anyway, is that like the list changes company by company. So you can never expect 100% of those 40 features to be present in all of the cases. What's more the case is like you want to see whether say 40% of that list of 40 are present in a new case that you come upon. And if 40% of that, you know, those things, like the technical things, the fundamental things and so forth, the insider buying, if those 40% are present, again, it doesn't guarantee that this company is going to make this comeback, but I think it's sort of, you've sort of passed a minimum threshold anyway, where it's probably more likely that this company has a shot of making it. But making it, you know, having a shot, like I don't think anybody can say when Carvana was at $3.50, like, nobody knows for sure it's going to go back to 400, but you want to make the prediction that like, does this have a chance to get to 10 bucks again? Does this have a chance to then go to 20 bucks? Can it go to 100 bucks? Like you have to sort of reassess along the way. And there's always like a list of negatives on why they won't achieve that the bears will always point to. But I guess what the bears don't always realize is that as the company makes this comeback and their stock price rises, their degrees of freedom, you know, that the management team gets to operate under, you know, gets easier and easier. They're given more latitude by the debt lenders and so forth. They're given more, they renegotiate their debt. All those covenants that the bears were warning were going to wipe out the company, you know, after a such and such date, suddenly the lenders have changed their tune when Carvana stock is at 50 bucks, you know, versus like when it was at $3. And so their lives get easier. And so suddenly, like, you know, they get more chances of success and more avenues to kind of operate under. So so that anyway, like when I came to Open Door, there was no insider buying, for example. I mean, in fact, it was just the opposite. There was like insider dumping constantly. And yet, there was, you know, the 40% of things that were present for Open Door that were similar to Carvana were things like, okay, similar kind of company operating in this like large market, this, you know, huge TAM. They're trying to disrupt it. They're trying to be the, you know, go direct, you know, show a different way of like doing real estate transactions where you don't need an agent, just like Carvana was trying to disrupt the traditional used car dealerships where you used to have to go to buy your car. And they are building out their national platform. They are, you know, not yet profitable, but they're sort of on the verge of profitability. The management team had kind of signaled that they were going to have their first EBITDA positive quarter in 3 years. And so like, that's the first step towards sustainable profitability. You had like, you know, it didn't take, you know, a rocket scientist to realize that the Fed was going to have to cut rates. at some point, you know, in the next 6 months. And probably that would be the beginning of like a, you know, sort of a cutting cycle. And that was going to be supportive of their business, just like it would be for Carvana or for whatever, an Upstart or one of these like more interest rate sensitive growth techie companies. So you had kind of those things as a positive, but then you also had insider dumping and you had like, you know, question marks hanging over the management team and the CEO. And like, you know, the CEO didn't seem as strong as Ernie Garcia was. So, but anyway, I also knew that Opendoor had great founders and who had left the company, like i.e. Keith Raboy from Coastal Ventures and Eric Wu, who had been the CEO there for a long time. And so, I mean, it's even though I use an AI model, it's not always 100% scientific. Like there, at some point, you got to sit back and look at all these factors that are in front of you on the table, and you have to apply human judgment, and you have to say like, okay, I think there's enough, you know, criteria that are being met here that this has the possibility of happening, and it's enough where I can move forward with this investment. And that's what I saw with Opendoor. And but then as you get into it, obviously you see things differently. You learn things, you know, some things that are better about the company, some things that are worse about the company. In my case, I felt like I had to take more of an activist position against the CEO and against, you know, some of the things the board was doing. I didn't anticipate that, you know, when I initially sent out my sort of tweet thesis on the company. So, you know, you evolve as the situation evolves. But anyway, that's how I approached Opendoor.
Yeah, and you can say that it's a home run so far. Like, obviously, it's gone up quite a bit. Not 100x yet, but 20. I think a 20x from the bottom, or maybe a little bit less these days. You're talking about this. You're going out, being really public about this. Comment on Twitter, both like as you said with the board and with the former CEO and so on. This for me, I bought it. I bought it at 1 and I sold most of it at 10. So obviously I'm happy. What scared me a little and maybe also scared the Danish investors a little bit is this meme movement, because all we hear in Denmark about this meme movement on especially Wall Street Bets is that, oh, it's casino game, which it's also kind of is. But still you're going out a little bit strong on this and also going out talking about this stock. How does it feel? Is it a part of your strategy, or is it just like culturally a little bit different way of doing things? Because it would not be a typical Scandinavian way of doing things. So how do you see that?
Well, Canada is very similar to Scandinavia in terms of like very conservative, very, mostly value investors that are in Canada. Like, I don't feel like I fit into Canada at all. And, so, but like, I mean, I didn't go about investing in Opendoor thinking that it would be a meme stock. Like that never crossed my mind. And so within the first week of me going public with it, the stock did have a very strong positive upward move. But I think it was only in the second week that it started to get called a meme stock. Because in that second week, that suddenly Krispy Kreme donuts was going up and GoPro went up, and then Sydney Sweeney did a TV ad for American Eagle, yeah. And I think American Eagle went up, and then so CNBC hadn't mentioned Opendoor at all in the first week, and in the second week, anytime they referred to it was like, well, the meme stocks are back,
yeah,
you know, exactly. So I don't know. Like, it didn't feel right because I had watched the meme stock movement in 2021 like everybody else, and I was amazed by what happened. I didn't always understand why. It seemed like a mob, you know, sort of suddenly ordained that GameStop was going to be their target, and then suddenly AMC became the target, and then BlackBerry became the target. Why those companies and not, you know, one of these other, you know, why not Twilio? Like, you know, I knew Twilio. I knew that was a real business. It didn't make sense to me back then that AMC became like the object of the affection of the retail crowd.
Yeah, it's like when a stock moves in a certain way price-wise, then you get the label on it. If stocks move up for a long time, it's a bubble. If stock moves up a lot in a short time, it's a meme stock. And so I guess it's the other side that looks at this and don't really get what it is. And I guess Opendoor was a very undervalued stock that like you said, it was a walking dead, and suddenly you had these changes. And we had the same headlines in Denmark in the newspapers, meme stocks are back. And I was like, no, this is just a very undervalued stock.
Well, the other funny thing was, Mads, that Carvana, everyone ignored. Like, I went on, like, I bought, so... My model flagged it at $11. It took us another week to check the model before I built the position. And in that week, the Carvana went up to $15. So my average position was like 15 when I got into Carvana. And then 2 weeks later, CNBC called me and said, hey, can you come on today and talk about Tesla? And I said, sure. And so like in that conversation, by that time, they had pre-announced like some, you know, better EBITDA in their current quarter than they expected. And so then the stock was like $25 by the, you know, this was like in early June. And in that conversation on CNBC, like I ended up kind of hijacking the conversation because it's live TV, and sort of ended up, even though I started talking about Tesla, I sort of steered it into talking about Carvana and why I thought Carvana was so great and all that. And I think, you know, at the end of the conversation, you know, and the host was like sort of, you know, it's TV, right? So they, like, I could have said like the sky is blue, and he would have said the sky is green, and come on, you know, we all know the sky is not really blue, and like that makes for better TV. But I remember afterwards the producer saying, oh, thanks, Eric, for coming on. But by the way, can you not talk about Carvana in the future? Because like our viewers only care about the Mag 7. Like nobody cares about small little stocks and everything. And so, And nobody tweeted about Carvana to me. No one said, hey, great idea. Like, I got to look into Carvana on Monday. It was just silence, indifference, right? And even the stock did well. I mean, the stock was volatile. I think between $15 and $200, there were three different times where I remember there was like huge drawdowns of like between 25% to like in one case, like 65% that Carvana drew down. So it was a hard stock to just buy and hold. But nobody commented about it. Nobody said, hey, this is the next Carvana. Like, it was just silence. Nobody said, like, this is a meme stock. I don't think I heard anything positive about Carvana until it got above $300 a share, you know, which was probably just earlier, you know, just within the last 6 or 12 months. And then now said, wow, now everyone's like, wow, this thing finally came back. But then when I started talking about Opendoor, like, immediately people were like, And I would use the phraseology, the next Carvana, right? And that immediately caught people's attention now, 2 years later. And then everybody was like, oh, the next Carvana. Or I'd hear like, I missed Carvana. I'm not going to miss Carvana again. And that's why I'm going to get into Opendoor now. Because I'm not, you know, I didn't catch Carvana before. So, you know, like there's also this FOMO, I guess, now present, that was a part of this. But to me, fundamentally, like it's not a fake company. Like Opendoor is a real company, following exactly in the footsteps of Carvana. It's a real turnaround. So I started calling it a cult stock because, you know, I never really profited much from Palantir, but obviously, like there was a group of people that really believed in Palantir and were always like, especially from retail, and they were always like saying, you know, this is great, great stock. But if you turned on CNBC, everybody was like always constantly coming on saying it was a terrible, it was too expensive on a price to sale. Even at $5 a share, people would go on TV and say it was like too expensive from a forward price to sales basis. And it's just a government contractor. Why should, you know, government contractors shouldn't be valued that way. But ultimately, like retail was right. The only other stock, like I remember that, dynamic was Tesla at the end of last decade, like from about 2014 until, I don't know, 2020. Like, you know, you had some people that thought Elon walked on water, and then other people that were the Tesla Q types that were saying like, this thing is a bankruptcy walking, and it's just a matter of time, this thing, it's a fraud and all this. So anyway, I think like Opendoor is going to end up being like that, where you just have this a bunch of people that are
big believers, and you know, and other people that just think it's a meme stock, and you know, hopefully, you know, the bulls will be proven right.
So, Eric, another group of stocks that are really interesting are the data center builders, and you've been having two Bitcoin miners on the radar, which are pivoting to doing AI data centers, Iron and Cypher. Could you take it away and tell us about them?
Sure. Well, they were my first two like 100 baggers that I flagged this year before Open Door, and I got really excited about them because they were seen as just part of the Bitcoin miners like Marathon, you know, and they were didn't always move up, you know, in a perfectly correlated manner with the price of Bitcoin. So even though Bitcoin was doing great in the first half of this year, the miners weren't really participating. And that's because there was a whole negative connotations that the miners had. A lot of these stocks, you know, paid their executives an enormous amount of compensation, and people didn't like that. And they were clearly like Iron and Cypher had years ago started this process of trying to pivot, or not to turn their backs on Bitcoin mining, because they were making good money from it, especially at the current prices, but they were using the free cash flow to invest into this sort of next business that would take them beyond just Bitcoin mining, which is getting into building AI data centers, and doing it less so from like CoreWeave tried to do it from the perspective of not owning any of the physical infrastructure, but just sort of being this middleware player and doing deals with the hyperscalers, but then partnering with the people on the ground that actually had the data centers built in order to fulfill the contracts. What Iron and Cypher were doing were more from the ground up, trying to actually buy the land, locate the land, you know, close to in close proximity to power sources where they could negotiate like cheap long-term, you know, energy contracts, then build the data centers themselves, in some cases like buy the Blackwell chips themselves, and then look to do deals later when everything was finished. And their assumption was there's not going to be enough of these data centers with, you know, access to power to keep up with the demands that we all are going to, you know, how much we're going to be using ChatGPT and how much other people are going to be using AI services. So they saw this like a few years ago, and even in May or June of this year, I don't think it was obvious that there was going to be this sort of power crunch. But now, you know, I think that is more conventional wisdom. And so what attracted me about Iron and Cypher was that they both had 3 gigawatts of these sort of plans to have these kinds of data centers built out and energized within the next 12 to 18 months. And so they would be perfectly, and that put them at, you know, ahead of others by far. Like Core Scientific was in this sort of bidding war with CoreWeave, and Core Scientific really only had a few 100 megawatts of power that they controlled, whereas we're talking 3 gigawatts each for Iron and Cypher. So I just felt like if there was going to be this revaluation at some point where these businesses would be valued in terms of what they had in terms of near term gigawatts that they could deliver to the market, and Iron and Cypher would be you know, seen as the best dance partners for the Oracles of the world, and you know, Microsoft's and others, Meta's. And so, you know, recently we had this Nebius deal with Microsoft for 1 gigawatt in the US, where it ended up being valued at almost like $18 billion, that 1 gigawatt. And it's going to be paid out by Microsoft, you know, $3 billion a year for like, I guess, 6 years or something. And Iron and Cypher still haven't announced their versions of those kinds of mega deals yet. So it's still to come, but their stocks have been moving up as people anticipate that those deals are going to be coming probably before the end of the year. So I still like them both. And people don't also take into account now that, you know, just because they have 3 gigawatts each coming online, I mean, there's going to be, you know, probably another 10 gigawatts, you know, that's under development or, you know, in the planning stages now that will come online, you know, a few years from now. So these, you know, they're not the only game in town. There are a lot of players out there. There is a mass shortage. So, you know, I'm kicking the tires on some other names now currently.
Can you reveal any of them?
Not yet, because I still want to build the fair positions. I don't want the stocks to start to fly up. But like, you know, this is going to be a sort of a theme, I guess, for the next probably 5 to 10 years, I think.
Yeah, we are also super bullish on Arena, especially because that, as you say, they own a lot of land around Houston, as far as I know, in Texas, and they are to build these products. I want to hear, what do you do with these positions in these stocks, especially when they go up this much? Do you just like stay long from the beginning, or do you sell a bit when to back some profit? How do you do that?
Well, I made a mistake with Carvana in how I traded that. I mean, I guess one of the first things I would say, Matthias, is that I actually, when I had my billionaire, who I reported to, he had a whole family office, right? He had like 50 people working for him, managing his money all day. You know, hopefully both of us will get to that stage of our lives where we've got 50 people running around managing our money for us. But the guy who was the chief investment officer for him was a Swede. And he tended to be a little bit more conservative. I think a little bit more from the value orientation, although he didn't mind making money on growth stocks for sure. And I remember like having so many conversations with him, you know, in the period from 2016 to 2020, where when I was investing in like the Twilios of the world and all this, and he would say, you know, Eric, your problem is you don't take a profit. You know, you know, a 3x isn't good enough for you. Like, what? It has to be a 5x. It has to be a 10x. Come on, you know, take a profit, you know, and he would always be encouraging me to like take the profit now. And my bias would be like to, oh no, you know, like all, I see all the possibilities. I see all the potential. I can't, you know, this is my baby. I can't, selling it now would be like turning my back on all those possibilities. So I've never been very good at following his advice. So when I got into Carvana, you know, I got in at 15. When it hit about 150, I kept, even though now he was gone out of my life, I kept hearing his voice in the back of my head, you know, telling me, what, a 10X isn't good enough for you. Okay. you know, come on, take a profit. So even though at 150 or 200, I did believe that they were, you know, Carvana was going to go back to 400 ultimately, because it was such a different kind of company than today than it was before. They made this major purchase of a business called Odessa right before their stock crashed. They were going to be much more profitable than they had ever been before. Anyway, but I took the profit. And then I said, but I justified it to myself saying, I'm such a smart guy. I was like the only guy who saw that Carvana was going to come back from the dead when it was 11 or 15 or whatever. So, and I know how volatile it is, because remember I said before, like they have all these stocks, you know, have huge pullbacks, huge drawdowns. And that's just sort of like the cost of doing business, of like owning these kinds of stocks. You have to be prepared to kind of deal with these gut-wrenching drawdowns, you know, and seeing like your paper profits evaporate into thin air, you know, as the stock pulls back from like 10 to $6 or something like that. And, but so I said to myself, like, well, I'm going to be smart, you know, I'll be even smarter and I'll trade, you know, I'll sell it at 180 and I'll buy it back at 140 and then I'll sell it at 230 and I'll... You say this to yourself, but the truth is, for me anyway, once I sold it, it just became a less, it wasn't something I looked at as closely in my portfolio. I suddenly became focused on my other current holdings much more than Carvana. And I missed the volatility. I just didn't keep up with it as much. And so I think if you added up my trades from like $150 to $400 from Carvana, I probably lost money on those trades. So when earlier this year, when I decided I'm going to, you know, recommit to 100 baggers only, I made a promise to myself. I'm not going to make that same mistake. And what I'm going to try to do is buy a huge amount of stock in a Carvana or an Opendoor, and some like long dated, you know, options if they're available, like they were for Opendoor. They weren't available for another stock I bought more recently called Better. At least not, they weren't when I built the position up. And I'll just hold them. And so that's pretty much what I've done with Opendoor. Like, and that's, you know, sometimes I buy on margin, and therefore, like, you know, you do trim here and there. I'm not saying I haven't sold Opendoor, but it, like the big core position, definitely I haven't touched, you know, since the very beginning. And now, like with all the management changes there, I mean, I don't see any reason to. I was at some dinner, and some Wall Street guy was like saying, "Oh, great job on Opendoor." He said, "What's the price that if it fell to is your stop loss? Where would you need to sell everything?" And this is when it was like around $10 a share. And I said, "You know, to be honest, I hadn't thought of it until he asked me that question." And I said, I don't think there could be. Like now with Kaz as the CEO and Keith as the chairman and Eric Wu back on the board, I mean, why would you, like, there could be a reason why it pulls back to like $4 because of the markets or like whatever, you know, Jerome Powell says something or Trump says something. But all those things are fleeting and they're going to change. And this is I know that people will eventually come back to the stock, and now it's run by a good management team. So, at least for now, I don't plan on trimming. Sometimes I might come across some new idea that suddenly gets me all excited and I think it's the next big, you know, investment idea. So maybe I would want to trim some at that point, depending on where the stock goes, you know, between now and then. But, I've just been sort of like buying and sitting on my bag to this point.
Here, last but not least, do you have any like new stocks that you can reveal to us that you believe can be the next Carvana or Opendoor here? Basically, what is going to make the Danes filthy rich so maybe we can buy a US instead of US have to overtake Greenland?
Let's see. I'm going to pull up my portfolio here. Well, I mean, the newest one that I've mentioned is called Better, Better Home and Finance, BETR. And so that one's a mortgage originator in the US, where, you know, they compete against Rocket Mortgage. They compete against, there's another one called UWMH, I think it is, It's kind of interesting because like those two companies, Rocket and UWMH, are run by guys that made so much money originating mortgages that they now own NBA teams, like basketball teams. So
wow.
Obviously there's money to be made in the mortgage market, but Better's run, like it's a much smaller company, run by a younger guy named Vishal Garg, who became famous in December of 2021, where he fired 900 people on a single Zoom call right after Powell like raised interest rates like 450 bips in a very short time. So so he got kind of a bad reputation, I guess, for seen as like a heartless CEO type who like fired all these people. But his business went from like $54 billion in originations like at the beginning of that year to like $5 billion, you know, after the interest rate hikes. It was a very cheap stock. I think they've made a huge investment in AI, and so now they're able to process more volume than they ever could do before. Like when he fired all those people, they were all people that worked offshore in India, actually, and who he had to get to fulfill the desire by people to get the mortgages. Now, so they're like one third the size in terms of employee headcount, and yet they're able to do like 5 or 6x the volume that they could do. And so, like, I know sometimes, you know, you turn on business TV And they're saying, is this investment in AI really worth it? Well, here's one company that, you know, has made this like a big investment in these last few years. You know, it's a totally different type of business. They're also an interesting, you know, there's a Scandinavian connection here too, which is that in like 10 years ago, when this guy Vishal was building his business, and he was trying to think of like, I got to build an AI matching system so I can match Matthias's background to like the best mortgage available to him that he can get. So he was trying to think of like, who can he hire to like lead his team? So he ended up hiring this guy. I think his name's Eric Bernhoffsen, I think is his last name. He's the guy who built the Spotify music matching engine for Spotify. So like basically 82% of the code that still runs today that matches your like musical picks on Spotify came from this like one guy, Eric, who he got hired away to work at Better. He no longer works there, but you know, he's sort of was like the original kind of like AI guru who kind of built the matching engine for Better. So I like them a lot. The other one that's kind of off the radar is there's a little Canadian company called BTQ Technologies, which does post quantum cryptography, which I didn't understand what that meant when I first heard about it, like about a year ago, when I first came across this company. But basically, everybody knows that like quantum computing is sort of going to be like the next, you know, next generation, I guess, of AI, you know, and we can have debates about like how long is it going to take for that, you know, quantum computer to actually emerge. But I think it's, you know, my bet it would be that it's going to happen much faster than, you know, than what we expect anyway, the way things are moving so quick these days. But that's potentially very threatening to anybody who owns crypto, because you could potentially crack the SHA-256, you know, algorithm with a quantum computer that was working, and kind of, you know, basically get access to anybody's crypto wallet, and you know, let alone like all the regular, you know, RSA, you know, technology that's protecting like, you know, government data or, you know, banks' data and all that kind of stuff. So BTQ is trying to be the, you know, almost like the CrowdStrike to protect against those quantum attacks.
They just IPO or what? Because if I put it up here on my screen, it only shows like
they've just recently uplisted to NASDAQ. So they were only a Canadian listed stock, and then they were on the OTC markets in the US. But just a week or two ago, they finally got permission to uplist to NASDAQ. So, but when you look, you know, all these quantum companies, like they all have virtually no revenue. And so people, you know, say, oh, it's terrible, you know, like therefore they shouldn't be valued as much. And that's true. But, you know, like their value, like some of these players like IonQ or D-Wave Systems or Rigetti, like they're valued now like $4 or $5 billion market cap companies. I think partly because it's sort of like a long term, it's almost like a VC type bet that there's, you know, they could be worth a lot in, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years time. BTQ is, you know, is only like a $700 million market cap. Has just as big a market opportunity as these other like better known American players. And I would argue, like, you know, they've got even, you know, some, you know, they've got even more business sense. They have chances of like real revenue producing opportunities in the next year or so that they're going after. And they've got patents and all that sort of stuff. So I just think it's too cheap still relative to where these other quantum names trade at.
We talk about Rigetti, right? Rigetti is up 4,000% this year or something like that as one of the bigger ones. So that is, really interesting. Eric, it's been a pleasure having you. Truly, thank you so much for joining us here today. And thank you for your tips, and also obviously with the open door. It's been really, really good and interesting to hear your case about Yahoo, Carvana, and obviously also open door. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. I look forward to doing the next one in person, because I love Scandinavia, and I almost did a master's degree in Bergen, Norway. And, loved, backpacked through Denmark and Sweden and Finland. So I look forward to coming back and seeing you in person, Matthias.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Jamen, fed snak, altså veltalende, som jeg sagde, og hyggelig at være sammen med og tale med. Og så synes jeg også inspirerende det her med at få en bare et andet syn på investeringen, en anden tilgang. Ikke så meget, meget mere praktisk tilgang, synes jeg, det slår mig som, altså hvor man sådan prøver at forholde sig til hver enkelt, og hvad er det sådan, der skal ske, ikke det her med frem med regnearkene, og så regner vi automatisk, men prøv ligesom at sætte sig ind i, hvad er det, der rører sig i den her aktie. Jeg synes, altså den der historie med Carvana, med at han rækker ud til nogle af de ansatte, og lige får fornemmelsen af, hvordan lyder de egentlig i stemmerne, og hvad siger de mellem linjerne og sådan noget. Jeg synes, det var sindssygt inspirerende tilgang til det, og jo meget mere værdifuldt end at sidde og kigge på kurver og tal og sådan nogle ting, fordi at virksomheden var på sådan en knivsæg, som den var. Så sindssygt spændende med en helt anden tilgang til investering og meget inspirerende. Og så med hensyn til Iron, så tror jeg, man kan sige, at det her, det var sådan lige en smagsprøve på Iron, fordi at vi har allerede lavet næste uges interview, som er med Frans Bakker, en Twitter-profil, en af dem, som virkelig dykker dybt ned i Iron-aktien, har været ude at besøge et af deres nye sites for datacenter og sådan noget, kender den aktie helt vildt godt, så, og et vildt godt interview, vildt god introduktion til den her investeringscase, som Iron og Cypher tilbyder.
Der er kun tilbage at sige tak til dagens annoncører. Det er tempogrowth.dk, pensionsplanlægning.dk og så månedsopdatering fra New Deal Invest eller på New Deal Invests fonde. God weekend til lytterne, god weekend til dig, Mads, og på genhør i næste uge.
I lige måde, Mathias.